In the history of Pulitzer Prizes and the Oscars, very few winners have turned down these awards. One of those who did was a famous Armenian-American, a writer from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. His name, William Saroyan. He turned down a Pulitzer for the drama called The Time of Your Life in 1940. Saroyan said he was opposed in principle to awards in the arts and was quoted as saying such arts awards vitiate and embarrass art at its very source. His son Aram, a well-known poet in his own right, has written a lot about his father and his relationship with him. We ask him to talk about his book, Last Rites, The Death of William Saroyan. Aram Saroyan, how often do you come across people that have no idea who your father, William Saroyan, was?
Well, you know, in the early days, because I'm now 78, about to go 79, very seldom. You know, his heyday was the 30s and the early 40s. And then post-war, he had a kind of eclipse because the whole spirit of the country changed after the war. And he had been a hero of the Depression years because he had come up with these ebullient stories in the face of the calamity, the economic calamity of the 30s. But then when the war was over and America was really the post-war hope for the Western world, he was considered a sort of rose-colored glasses romantic, which I don't think was a fair assessment of who he was, but that his reputation went into a kind of eclipse. These days, I think he's coming back into favor. People are realizing that his best work is going to endure. You know, I'm talking about pieces. Well, the original My Name is Aram, which was published 3 years before I was born, and is really, I think, one of the very first, if not the first, multicultural piece of writing in America, gave birth to a whole new genre. I mean, people named their kids Aram not because they were Armenian or Persian, but just because they loved the book. And then a play like The Time of Your Life, which has been an enduring theater classic for, you know, over half a century.
What was
all of that is? Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, what was The Time of Your Life about? And it was in the introduction that you didn't hear, I said that he refused the Pulitzer Prize for that back in 1939. What was it about?
It was about a waterfront saloon in San Francisco on the eve of the war, I think, or of America's involvement in the war. And he was, you know, at that time, he was the ripe old age of 30. And 5 years earlier, nobody was paying any attention to him at all. He broke through with his story collection, The Daring Young Men on the Flying Trapeze, in 1934. And I think it was, there were a lot of impulses behind that rejection. I mean, his official position was that commerce had no business patronizing art. You know, he got $1,000 prize with the prize, $1,000 worth of cash, and he didn't need it. At that time, he was among the best paid writers of his generation. So there was that, and there was also kind of thumbing his nose at the hierarchy, that the literary gatekeepers that really hadn't responded earlier. There's a whole lot of stuff, and just being young and ebullient and saying, I don't need this.
This particular podcast episode is kind of a point of personal privilege for me. I want the listeners to know that, because it's not, I've not asked you to talk to us because of politics. I've asked you to talk to us something I've always wanted to, I met you, you won't remember, in 1961 at Purdue University in Lafayette, Indiana, where I was a student. And I worked as your father's rehearsal assistant in a play that he wrote on campus as an artist in resident called The High Time Along the Wabash. And
I remember that. I remember the visiting him. I believe my sister was with me, Lucy. But it's funny because I was talking with somebody today, and there was a wonderful character in the play. And he read the line in a way that I could never quite understand, but then it came through to me. The line was, the way he read the line was, what do you want me to do? and the line was, what do you want me to do? But it was funny, you know. I do remember that.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Well, I read your book, and that's one thing I want to talk to you about, called Last Rites, the death of William Saroyan as chronicled by his son, Aram Saroyan. I read it years ago. It came out in 1982, and I reread it within the last year. So I'm honored that we could have this chat. Let me read you the very favorable review on your book back in 1982 from the New York Times. And I'm just going to take a quote that they ran out of it, because it obviously got their attention and get you to respond. The quote from your book was, "My father never liked me or my sister, and he never liked our mother either. After an initial infatuation, and in fact, he never liked anyone at all after an hour or two. No, one except a stooge, someone he could depend on to be a lackey." I'm getting the sensation that I may have been that lackey. "A nitwit he could make fun of behind his back. Someone he could control completely by whatever means he could make work, fear, intimidation, or because of he was famous and an admired man, blind worshipfulness." All that's a mouthful, but why did you write that?
Well, that was written at the beginning of the book, and really, the book is a diary. Unlike anything I've ever written before or after, it was written in 3 weeks after we got the news that after Lucy and I got the news that our father was dying, and we put aside all the differences that both of us had with him. She hadn't seen him in about a decade. I hadn't seen him in 3 or 4 years, and decided that she was living in Beverly Hills at the time, and I was in Northern California in Bolinas, Marin County. She was going to go visit him, take up a basket of a lunch basket and knock on his door, because she'd heard from his attorney that he basically wanted to have her, to see her. And so she packed up and drove to Fresno, and he was very mean to her. He wouldn't. He let her in for a moment, and then threw her out of the house. While she was there, he said to her, "Does Aram know?" And she said, "Yes, he does," because she had phoned me with the news, having heard from his lawyer that he had cancer. And he said, "Oh, that's just great." She said, he said, I could strangle Aram Kevorkian, who was the name of his lawyer, with my bare hands. And then ended by saying, "Tell Aram not to call, not to write, and not to phone. He'll kill me if he does." And Lucy called me from a phone booth in Fresno and said, because we were going to, my wife and I and our kids were going to come down the next day, drive down, and we were going to have some kind of family reunion. She was in tears. She said, "Don't come down here, Art. Don't come down here." And it was an odd situation. I'd been kind of keeping a diary at the time, and the diary just at that moment just exploded, and all the anger that I had felt growing up, the son of a guy who was just misperceived by the media, essentially as the writer of the warm family sagas, My Name is Aram and the Human Comedy. I remember people saying, "Oh, he must be the most wonderful father in the world." And being a young, being a child and then a young man, I thought, well, maybe he is. I'm not sure, you know. And I certainly didn't want to disagree with the public perception. That was too big a job. So basically, I just went along with that and didn't think about it that much and went about my own life. But with that call, a lot of anger was released, especially in the first couple of chapters of the book. What was interesting to me about it was that there was genuine emotion in it. And I think when the emotion is genuine, it's fluid. It changes. It metamorphoses. And on the heels of the anger, there was this sort of sympathy and insight into the fact that this was a man who was orphaned before he was 3 years old. He and his older siblings went into the Fred Finch orphanage in Oakland because their father had died. And he lost essentially both mother and father because she took work as a domestic and visited when she could. Takui, his mother, his father's name was Armanok. So then the book proceeds from there. And what was fascinating to me, because I was both monitoring his progress, keeping my distance because he had sent that warning to Lucy. And at a certain point, first of all, there were a lot of memories that kept coming up and that I would write down as they occurred to me. And then at a certain point, I was having a memory about being 8 years old after my father's and mother's second divorce. They married and divorced twice by the time I was eight, and I was living with my mother and younger sister in a one-bedroom apartment at the corner of Olympic Boulevard and McCarty Drive in Beverly Hills. And my mother was just zonked. She was like a 28-year-old woman who had obviously made a serious life mistake, was now a single mom with two kids, and so on. And I had a two-wheeler, and I was in front of the apartment building, and I picked up the bike and spun the wheel just to look at the spokes disappeared as I spun the wheel. And suddenly all the noises of the neighborhood went kind of wacko. It was like some kind of wrinkle, sonic wrinkle just infected the whole noise. And I was remembering this moment. This kind of thing happened maybe three or four times during that period. And I realized, why am I remembering this? And the reason I was remembering it was because having to keep my distance from him the way he had asked or commanded or mandated or whatever you'd say, I was going a little nuts again. And I realized, I don't care what he says. First of all, he's dying. So whether I hurry the death along, it really is irrelevant at this point, and I have to see him. And at that point, I decided to go down and see him with our younger daughter, who had always charmed him. And I figure I'll get into the room with her along. Her name is Cream. And what happened then was a kind of resolution that I could never have anticipated. And it turned into a healing, a deathbed healing for me. And then Lucy was able to come down a second time, and things went better. And what was really interesting about that to me was that the writing itself reached a point where the only way I could continue was through an action. It kind of mandated that I do something rather than simply continue to write. And so that was the trajectory of that began with the anger and ended with the healing. And I was very worried about the reception of the book. I'd written a book about the Beat Generation that came out a couple of years earlier, and gotten a couple of big bad reviews. And I thought, Jesus, I'm going to get crucified for this book, you know, because I'm taking on a kind of a literary Santa Claus here, and nobody's going to like this. Well, in fact, the book got wonderful reviews all over the place. And what was even more wonderful is that people wrote to me, and they didn't write to me about a famous father. They wrote to me about their own families and how, you know, there's this, you know, double bind sometimes when a parent is perceived in a certain way that it really doesn't sync with who that person is, if you know them in your family, you know. So it was a very healing experience on many levels, and I also had put down this baggage that I've been carrying for 37 years of being the son of this famous guy, and he's still. You know, he was famous for decades and is still famous. Wasn't the kind of, you know, movie star fame of the 30s and 40s. But like I say, I think he was an enduring writer. And I feel very differently about him now. I mean, you know, he's first of all, I'm older than he was when he died.
He was 71. 72?
72, yeah, 72.
Well,
and he had prostate cancer, and he could have done a routine operation to prolong his life. He didn't do that. He decided not to do it. But I must say, the way he died, he was alert, awake, and very, you know, in full possession of all his faculties and did some wonderful stuff. He kind of gave me the last scene of the book. You know, I went over to him at the end of a hospital visit that might have lasted an hour or so, and he seemed to be asleep, and my daughter kissed him, and he looked up, kind of startled, and then I came forward, and I said to him, I was going to kiss him before I left as well, and I said, goodbye, Pop, and I just put, you know, I bent down to kiss him on the forehead, and I felt his arm around my shoulder, and suddenly I was holding him in my arms. He was very light. The cancer had just ravaged his body, and it was like, you know, the strong neck and everything was soft. It was like holding a baby, and I said, goodbye, Pop, and he said, goodbye, arm. He said, it's the most beautiful time of my life and death. A classic Saroyan line. Anyway, so that's a story in that book.
When I think back of my brief time with him, 4 months, and I was a student, this was a requirement in a drama class that you either acted in the play or you built the sets, or in this case, acted as a rehearsal assistant. What I most remember about him, first of all, he was not the slightest bit controversial during the time he was on campus, but he dressed in a black suit every day, a black shirt, a black tie, black shoes, black socks, and drove a black car that the university provided to him, and was personable to everybody. When I think about that, I want you to kind of fill in the blanks about him, because one of the things that is you write about it, and there's a lot of copy about it, is the mustache and the role that that played in the image of William Saroyan.
Yeah, it's interesting because that mustache, you know, up to that time, he began wearing a mustache, and it was a much more modest one in those early days. But he had been a very handsome man about town, who was, you know, just an American guy. My mother said to me, you know, years later, she said, when I met your father, he was he looked exactly, I mean exactly, like Al Pacino in The Godfather. And so then suddenly around the age of 40, when his reputation had gone into eclipse, he returned to an older image that would have been identifiable in his father, who had a big handlebar mustache, who had died young. He became more of an Armenian than he had been. And partly because of the adulation of the Armenians, who loved him. You know, this was a horrible period for the Armenians. The genocide, which is still unrecognized by the official Turkish government, although I think many Turkish citizens are shamed by that position, that official line. But Saroyan was, at that time, perhaps the most famous Armenian. And because of the media and all the changes that had occurred, at that time, perhaps the most famous Armenian of all time. I mean, that would now be, you know, Kim Kardashian and Cher. You know, and he's a beloved figure, especially to the Armenians, although I will meet Armenians who love him, and there are certain statements that he's made that are that are in on placards and framed in homes in Armenia and in the diaspora. But a lot of times, you know, they'll say, William Saroyan, you know, and is a semi-deity. But the interesting thing is, if you ask them, well, what is, do you have a favorite book? Or is there something you particularly like by him? And a lot of times they haven't read him, which isn't to say that, you know, he's been on media. He's, you know, he's been very available. And so there's a wonderful clip of him actually going the rounds on the internet of an interview with Dick Cavett late in his life, where you see an enormous mustache, and he's absolutely charming. You know, he's a terrific. He kind of ended up just going back to the artist that he had been originally, after surviving, you know, the sort of huge success that was then diminished because of a zeitgeist shift, and then just doing some of his very best work at the end of his life. So he did well, I think. You know, couple, he's an exemplary.
Couple things that I want to have you expand on. One is that when he died, the ashes were eventually split between Fresno, California, and Armenia. Armenia, a country that used to be a part of the Soviet Union, has a population of about 3 million. Do you happen to know, by the way, how large the diaspora is of the Armenians?
I don't, but I imagine it's much larger in number than the 3 million. That Glendale and Burbank in Los Angeles are really the best, the most heavily populated places in the diaspora.
If you get online, there's a lot. It takes a while, but you can find a lot. Documentaries, his artwork, a lot of things that he's written. But why Fresno? And how many Armenians, or what's the why did Armenians pick Fresno in this, and what kind of a town is it? And his name's on everything there.
Yeah, my understanding is that while they were Armenok managed to get to America around 1905.
His father.
Yes. His father. And after he was there for a year or two, and he was an ordained minister, and apparently his command of English was good enough that he had his own parish on the East Coast. I don't know whether it may have been in Paterson, New Jersey, one of his sponsors was a minister named William Stonehill. And eventually he was able to get Takawi and their three children, Cosette, Zabel, and Henry, to the East Coast. But Takawi didn't really like being on the East Coast, and they got a letter from someone in Fresno who said, you know, come out here. The climate apparently was similar to what they had known in Armenia. They came originally from Bitlis, Armenia, which I believe is part of Turkey today. And my father was the only one of his siblings to be born in America. And I believe it must have been a happy time for that family, because it was a reunion. He was born in 1908 in Fresno, and Armenok died, I believe, in 1911 of an appendicitis. He wasn't able to get his footing in Fresno. The parish that had been promised or had just been a ruse or a lie never happened. And he became a chicken farmer. And I think he'd pretty much lost his feeling for what had happened, you know, for his own life. And essentially, the story goes, I don't know whether it's a myth or not, but the story goes that he was brought into the house by a couple of farmhands and laid on a sofa. And it was obvious that he was very ill, and I think maybe appendicitis was suspected. But he begged Tockley for a glass of water, which was not the proper medicine for his situation. And she brought it to him. He drank it and died. Well, whether that's true or not, it may just be mythology. It was a story that he knew, and it must have been confusing to him as he was growing up, because it was, you know, kind of implicated his mother and his father's death.
On him, but on your father personally, how much education did he have?
Well, he only went to, I think, through the eighth grade, but then he went to technical school to learn typing. And, of course, he was reading constantly. The thing is, when he emerged at 26, he was able to produce stories that were like a kind of fluent and very readable adaptation of all the modernist writers of that period. I mean, he was one of the last modernists, and he made it palatable for a large audience. And, you know, it was just a terrific presence in literature in a very dark time. And because he had endured the orphanage, he had somehow managed to steel himself to the calamities that life could turn that could come through in a person's life. And he was able to handle the emotional cataclysm of the Depression in a way that no other writer could. You know, Steinbeck wrote The Grapes of Wrath. And he wrote My Name is Aram, which is just lyrical, and you would never guess that this is written by an orphan. It's funny, there's a wonderful letter that Steinbeck, who was his closest contemporary, wrote to Pop just when those first stories in My Name is Aram were appearing in the Atlantic Monthly. And, you know, there's with his first few books after The Daring Young Man, you can feel him reaching into his second drawer and saying, I can get some money for this, and sending out stuff that was really second tier. Steinbeck wrote to him and just said, you know, Bill, in these new stories, you're telling stuff that only you know. And I thought, geez, what a wonderful, generous gift it was for John Steinbeck to write that. There is even a rumor that at a certain point, both of them were considered for the Nobel, and they gave it to Steinbeck because they figured Saroyan might turn it down.
Well, he had a 29-cent stamp that was issued by the United States in 1991. He also was on a banknote in Armenia, may still be. But I want to ask you about the reaction for him, and for you, for that matter, that your mother, Carol, married Walter Matthau and was married to him for years and years and years.
Yes. Well, as far as Walter goes, I remember him saying, I like Walter. He's a lucky guy. He thought he was terrific. And Walter was in a couple of Pop's plays that are on a DVD that we have. One is a short play called Once Around the Block. That's quite, it's a terrific piece. And the other is his first Broadway play, My Heart's in the Highlands. Both of which was a young Walter Matthau is a star of both. And, Walter respected Pop, and they didn't know each other. They didn't socialize. But and Carol, was my mother, was she was an 18-year-old, actually like him in her earliest years, a foster child, none of which he knew about when they married. But he once said to me, in a sober mood, he said, I fell in love with your mother's past. And I think what he meant by that was that the two of them were orphans. And I think there was, it was her first love, and it was a rocky ride for her because she was not equipped to be married to this guy who was about in his mid-30s when she was barely out of her teens. I mean, she wasn't. She was 19 when I was born. It was tough on her. She never forgot that how hurt she had been by what happened between them. Whereas Pop, gradually over the years, and he was very embittered, at certain times, he forgave her. And he, at the end of his life, with all the problems, I mean, he, basically disinherited his two children and his grandchildren and so on.
So you got nothing from your father when he died?
We got something, but it was a little bit complicated. It was ownership of a property that we had lived on in Bolinas that he had bought. And the idea was that he would pass it on to us. And in fact, he didn't. And we eventually were able to get it through legal.
Where are you today, physically?
Physically, I live in Newport Beach right now.
And your life as a writer, is it continuing? Are you still writing? And what are you writing?
Actually, in the last, I would say about the last 5 years, I've been doing art, and you can see some of that on Instagram. I'm at Saroyanesque, which is a word that people coined back in the day for the quality of my dad's writing, but I just borrowed it.
How much?
So, yeah, Go ahead.
How much are you like your father?
Well, these days, I'll tell you, I feel very lucky to have known him. It was a great gift. And one of the things I recognized over the years is because I had, you know, friends with fathers who lived at home and so on. And I realized I really knew the guy because even though I saw him mostly on summer vacations after they divorced, he was there 100% when you were with him. And he was a wonderful teacher, not in an explicit way, but just in ways that he demonstrated. I remember when I was writing minimal poems back in the 60s, Lucy and I shared a one-bedroom apartment with him in Chelsea, just off the King's Road, for about 2 months. We were in our early 20s. He was in his 50s and sort of in the lion winter phase of his life. But he was doing sort of late-inning parenting with his two 60s kids and was really almost maternal. I mean, he would make Armenian recipes and we'd talk together. I remember one night, Lucy and I were both camped out on sofas in the living room, and he got the bedroom. But we were chatting about something. I think, one of us was maybe stretched out on the sofa or whatever. And he was standing at the door, and he said, at the end of some exchange, he said, "Well, good night, kids." And he switched off the light. We were all in complete darkness. And then he switched it back on, doubled over in laughter, you know. It was funny. He was fun and sort of my favorite memories of him.
You write in your book, it has made it possible for him to remain unknown, not only to his public, that is, but also by giving him the easy out of the adulation, and in the case of Armenians, the outright coddling of their unquestioning and, in fact, blind acceptance to remain, in essence, unknown to himself as well. You're talking about his fame. How did he...
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, what were you going to say? How did he what?
I was just going to ask you, how did he deal with the fact that he wasn't as well known as he was, say, during World War II, later on in his life?
Well, I think he returned to his roots as just as a modernist artist. He was engaged by writing and by art because he did a lot of drawings and watercolors and so on, which he didn't do much about publicizing. But he was an artist. That's what he was. And it's not an easy journey in America. It's not a culture that really appreciates the independent, non-academic unaffiliated artist. That voice is an exception. How many actual writers that we would consider artists are there in America today? Are there 100 of them? You know, other than, you know, people who have essentially made their living through the media or through academia or through Time, Life, Newsweek, whatever, or TV, or the movies. And that's not to denigrate any of them. However, they find whatever path they find, I think the contributors. But he was one of the exceptions who was able to live his life and find things that he wanted to do that came specifically out of his reality. And that's an exceptional situation for a writer in America. Not many of them survive. The people who survived, who were closest to him as figures over the years, I think are, for the 20s, I think Fitzgerald was comparable to what Saroyan was in the 30s. And after Saroyan, because he acknowledges him as a big influence, the next figure would have been Kerouac. And both Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Kerouac died in their 40s, whereas Saroyan, in spite of what happened, you know, with his reputation and both, and that happened with both Kerouac and Fitzgerald as well, lived 72 years, you know. So he was a survivor as well.
How much did gambling and the loss in gambling play in his life and, for that matter, yours?
Well, I was never a gambler, but I think he equated having a financial handicap, because he was, you know, dirt poor as a young writer, with the alchemy of what he was able to create. So at a certain point, when things were down, he was compulsive. But he survived. He survived all that. He died with a, you know, it was 81. He had $1.5 million estate, if not more. You know, he was okay. He took care of himself. He was eccentric. He was a hoarder. He had all kinds of, you know, issues, but he kept on.
What happened, you know, to the Fresno house?
Well, the Fresno, what, the original house?
Well, I know that there's been a lot of attention given to the foundation and also a museum. And where is the museum? And why has Fresno held on to this Saroyan name all these years?
Well, he put Fresno on the map. There's a passage in Kerouac's On the Road where Kerouac is in Fresno, and he just muses, so this is Saroyan's town. You know, he's the beloved son of that place.
Have you participated in keeping all this alive yourself?
I haven't been in contact. I mean, I was persona non grata after last rites, but the Armenians and I are getting along. We're doing okay. You know, they've forgiven me and I've forgiven them. I mean, you know, they're a wonderful people. They really are. And they've had a tough run. You know, they're basically, I think, a wonderful people.
Let me ask you about one, because I've watched a bunch of the documentaries that are around, and I want to run a clip from a man, and you can pronounce it for me when I'll give it a try. Charles Butch Yagian. I'm sure that's not right. Do you know that name?
Janigian, I think. Is that who you're talking about?
He was sitting on a couch around with some of the family members because family seemed to be important. Let me run this and get your reaction to what he said about your father.
Okay.
I remember towards the end when Willie was in the hospital in Fresno and he was on his deathbed. It was Uncle Archie who actually tried to get Willie's children, both Lucy and little Aram, into the hospital to see Bill, to make peace. There had never really been any animosity from Bill to the children, but Bill felt that the children basically had let him down and had sided with the mother through the divorces and had taken the mother's side on the family history rather than his, and they didn't understand him. And it was Archie who brought Lucy to the hospital, who did ultimately tell her father, who she called Pop, mm-hmm. I love you. And I don't know exactly what happened with little Aram, but I know they tried to make up at the end as well.
By the way, ran a clip for two reasons. One, the music in the background. Come On to My House. I want you to talk about that in a minute. That's from a documentary called Soroyan's Will in 2008. What'd you think of that comment?
Oh, well, he got everything wrong, but that's okay. I mean, Charles is really, first of all, Archie is a beloved figure for me. He was Pop's cohort as an artist. He's a wonderful poet, and his, first cousin. Their mothers were sisters, and also lost his father early. He had nothing to do with Lucy getting there. And little Aram is a relation is, I was 37 at the time. He's talking because Big Aram was Uncle Aram, who was Pop's father's surrogate when he was growing up, and a difficult figure and also an inspiring figure for Pop. But he means well, and he's trying to sort things out, but he doesn't really know the history, and he hasn't availed himself of the books about it that have been written by me and others. So that's all I can say about that.
Someone my age, and you're not too far behind me, will remember "Come On to My House," sung by Rosemary Clooney. What did your father have to do with that song?
Well, Ross was another cousin, and they were very close. And
Ross Bagdasarian.
Yes, Ross Bagdasarian. And that song came out of, I believe, a cross-country drive. Ross played the pinball addict in the original Broadway production of The Time of Your Life. And I believe they... maybe after the play closed, the two of them drove across the country, and during that time, they kind of resurrected an Armenian folk song that became "Come On to My House." Ross was a real musician, and later did the singing Chipmunks and a whole. A lot of terrific music, but and he was very important in launching the piece, but gave half credit to Pop, and I'm sure Pop contributed to it. And it's a wonderful it's a great American songbook.
In your life, you've been celebrated for a number of things, including the world's shortest poem, which is in the Guinness Book of Records. Tell us about that.
Well, this was during the 60s. And it was a period of, you know, modernist experiments. And I was a young poet and found myself intrigued by what was then called concrete or minimalist poetry, and wrote a lot of poems in about a 2 or 3 year period. That couple of books were published in 68 and 69 by Random House, Arms, Rowan, and Pages. And then recently, more recently in the new millennium, were reprinted all of the books of that period. And that was a wonderful time. And those poems, I think, were part of the notoriety or the fame of many of those pieces have to do with the internet. When I first got on the internet, I was surprised to find that the books were already there, you know, and they were getting as much or more attention digitally than they had in print.
What was the world's shortest poem?
I was working as a paste-up person. This is before computers and where you could, you know, get clean copy. And there was a big M. And I thought, what would happen if I added another hump to this letter? So I just pasted that up. And that was... That was the wordless shortest poem.
But what did it? What was it supposed to mean?
I don't know. You need to look at it and figure it out. I have no idea.
Well, what about the other poem, Light?
Light is interesting because that's a poem where really, okay, I was, you know, 21 or 22, and I was playing with language, and really the whole issue in that poem is, well, do you add 1 GH or do you add 2 GHs or what? And so it was like an aesthetic decision to add, to do LIGHGHT. If you added LIGHTGHT, which some people had misprinted it as, that doesn't work. Nor does LIGHGT or whatever. So, okay, it was pretty much a done deal when you did it, but it involved a lot of, it involved an aesthetic decision. And then it involved, like, would somebody publish it? And in fact, because of concrete poetry, the Chicago Review published it. And it won an NEA award that was given by a distinguished American poet. And when I say an award, it was $500 to me and $250 to the Chicago Review for printing it. And Robert Duncan chose the poem, and he is, I believe, one of the major American poets of the 20th century. But a congressman got a hold of this and took it onto the floor of Congress, said this is a misuse of public money at the rate of, you know, $87.36 per letter. At that point, they went nuts and cut the NEA budget several million dollars. And they would use that poem periodically as a sort of laser tool to cut the budget. whenever they wanted to get rid of the NEA.
When you look back at that, Nat, what year would that have been? 65?
The poem was written in 65, I believe, fall of 65, yeah.
What are your thoughts when you realize that a poem with one word, L-I-G-H-G-H-T, won a national endowment for the arts $750 award? What does it look like to you at your age now?
Well, it was an honor.
Well, I'm not really getting at it.
There's a very funny story. I ran into Robert Duncan that year. We were both in Berkeley, and we were waiting for a bus to go back into San Francisco. And we got on the bus, and Duncan was an extraordinary talker, and I was basically just listening. But at a certain point, he said, "You know, there were poems by you that year that were more traditional, and I could have chosen one of those." Said, "But an angel told me to choose that poem." And I thought, God, I wish he'd given a press conference back then and alerted people, you know, because government has no business making judgments about it, about what this is. For whatever reason, it's one of the poems that people know today. That's all. And it's not even my business. It just happens to have happened.
What do you think it means?
Well, I think during the 60s, one of the things that happened for my generation was that space itself got more vivid, maybe through psychedelics, maybe through just what was going on. It was a melting kind of clock situation for a generation. And that poem is about that on some level. And it also was an intriguing object to me because the GHs are silent. And so you can add them in. And if it's in lowercase, which it should be, it's a wonderful shape. And so I just liked it. It was a combination of, I guess, visual and literary. And it just struck a nerve.
On a personal basis, what impact did it have on you? You lost your sister, Lucy. What was it? Was it 2008?
It was 2003, actually. Yeah.
And you lost your wife 2 years ago?
Yes.
So, I mean, it's, I suppose, an obvious question, but what impact did both of those have on you personally?
Well, with Galen, the loss was, very, very hard. You know, she was my wife of over half a century, and she was a terrific person. And, my love for her is indelible. And with Lucy, the same thing. And Lucy was troubled. She had problems, like we all do. And she was a wonderful person. So I miss her. I miss, of course, Galen.
Here's a quote from, I've got a number of quotes from your father, and then we'll wrap this up. He said, "I have managed to conceal my madness fairly effectively. And as far as I know, it hasn't hurt anybody badly, for which I am grateful."
Well, yeah, well, I think you needed to check with a couple of other people on that one.
All right, here's another. Go ahead.
Well, that's all. All I've got on that one.
Here's another one. I'm enormously wise and abysmally ignorant.
Well, if you get to reading a book like Obituaries, which was the last book he published during his own lifetime, it's the longest prose work of his career. And in spite of having some cheap shots at Lucy and me, and of course, Carol, it's a terrific piece of work. And he is a combination of storyteller and philosopher at his best. And Obituaries is an extraordinary book. It's not an easy book, but it's a terrific book, and it got some good reviews.
All right, here's another one. The only person I have ever really loved is Saroyan, and all that I really love now is the little of Saroyan still left in me.
Yeah, and that's one that I discovered as a note to himself when we were spending a summer in Paris with him when I was 15. And I thought that, I just took note of that. And that's a sad commentary, on, I think his fame was in eclipse at that point, and it was a tough time for him. That was the summer that my mother remarried in New York while Lucy and I lived with Pop in Paris. This is kind of a sad note. Doesn't really need to endure because I think he went way beyond that. But for that time, it was 1959. He was 50.
One last quote. In Obituaries, which you mentioned earlier, by the way, are any of his books still in print?
Oh, absolutely. My Name is R, The Human Comedy. I don't know about Obituaries. There are many anthologies of his work, and like I say, the theater classics are done all the time. The Time of Your Life, and so he's in currency.
But the quote out of the book is from your father, William Saroyan, an idiot father. This is his quote. I'm an idiot father of a young and stupid son and a younger and more stupid daughter.
Okay, Pop. Thank you for that. I don't know. Like, this is family dirty laundry. I mean, there's nothing to say about something like that. He was in a bad mood.
But you're able to laugh at it many, many years later.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't exactly something that was going to force me to commit suicide. he was a great guy who also had some bad stuff happened and did the best he could. And he did great. So
let me remind the audience of the book. Hey, by the way, is Last Rites still available? The book?
Last Rites is on Kindle, yeah. It's available on Kindle.
Our guest has been Aram Saroyan, talking to us today from Newport Beach, California. Author of Last Rites, The Death of William Saroyan, as chronicled by his son, and lots of other works that you can easily find on the internet. And I want to thank you so much for filling in the blanks for me after these last 61 years.
Okay, Brian, thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.